You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 13, The Corsican Gracchi. Thanks for joining me. We left off last time in early 1790. Napoleon was back on Corsica. He and his brothers, Joseph and Lucien, were poised to enter politics. They were young men. Joseph was 21, Napoleon 20, and Lucien just 15. But they had big ambitions. Despite their youth and inexperience, the Bonaparte brothers had attracted the interest of a powerful patron, Christophe Salicetti, who was one of Corsica's representatives to the Assembly in Paris. Salicetti was a fervent Jacobin and a major player in the revolutionary government. So the Bonapartes may have been young, but with an influential benefactor and all the new opportunities for advancement created by the revolution, their quest for power wasn't quite as quixotic as it might look at first glance. But they were still small-time players on the Corsican political scene. The big news on the island in 1790 had nothing to do with the Bonapartes. The revolutionary government had declared an amnesty for all Corsicans still wanted by authorities for resisting the French occupation. Pasquale Paoli, the hero of the War of Independence and the only man to ever lead an independent Corsica, was coming home after more than 2 decades of exile in Britain. Almost everyone on the island celebrated his return. Paoli had been a unifying figure when he was in power, able to appeal to all elements of Corsican society. The Bonapartes were excited too. Paoli was their hero. Napoleon in particular idolized him. As recently as June 1789, he'd written Paoli a fan letter, saying, quote, "I hope to be able to go to London, to express the sentiments you have awakened, and to talk over the misfortunes of our country. But I am too far away. Perhaps a day will arrive when I shall be able to overcome this obstacle," end quote. Paoli received a lot of letters from admirers. He was a celebrity. There's no evidence he read Napoleon's, but if he had, the signature at the bottom must have given him pause. Napoleon Bonaparte, officer in the Lafayre Regiment. What was a French officer doing writing such a gushing letter to a famous leader of the anti-French Corsican resistance, who was being sheltered by France's greatest enemy? Napoleon's letter makes perfect sense if you know the context of his background and beliefs. But it might have seemed strange to Paoli and his entourage, maybe even a little suspicious. The name Bonaparte might have raised some eyebrows, too. Carlo Bonaparte had served as Paoli's secretary and stayed by his side through the doomed war with France, right up until the bitter end. But after the war, Carlo declined Paoli's invitation to accompany him into exile and went to work for the French. Paoli couldn't forgive that. In his eyes, Carlo had been a collaborator, a sellout, a traitor. Remember, this is an era in which people put a lot of stock in family ties. In the eyes of Paoli and many of his inner circle, Carlo's actions tainted his sons as well. Upon his return to the island, Paoli was immediately showered with titles and honors, including the presidency of the Corsican Regional Assembly and command of the Corsican National Guard. Overnight, without a shot being fired, he was the most powerful man on the island once again. Of course, it was a bit different this time around. He would be under French sovereignty, sharing power with a French governor. Paoli was 65 years old and had been away for 22 years. Joseph and Napoleon were members of the welcoming committee for the old general. But according to some sources, they mostly just annoyed him by criticizing his tactics on a tour of the battlefield of Ponte Novo, the site of Paoli's final defeat by the French. So the first impression they made on their idol was obnoxious sons of a traitor, not a promising start to the relationship. On one hand, it's quite natural that the Corsicans handed Paoli so much power immediately upon his return. He had proved an incredibly capable leader during his time ruling the island. His government had been popular, and importantly, it was broadly popular. People from all walks of life and all regions of Corsica approved of Paoli. Corsican politics were fractious and prone to infighting. Paoli had risen above all that and been a leader for the whole island rather than just a narrow constituency. In exile, Paoli's popularity had only grown. Actually governing means getting your hands dirty, making tough choices that will inevitably leave some people dissatisfied. Off in London, away from the day-to-day reality of Corsican politics, Paoli didn't have to worry about that. He remained a pure romantic figure in the Corsican imagination, almost more of a folk hero than a real flesh-and-blood politician. But for some of those same reasons, it was incredibly dangerous to have given him so much power. Paoli wasn't some folk hero come to life. He was a human being with flaws and biases. Everyone knew the Paoli legend, but no one had seen Paoli the man for over 2 decades. It was easy for that legend to be all things to all people. That's why it was something that could be embraced by both conservative nobles and Jacobins like the Bonapartes. But once he was back on the ground in Corsica, invested with real power, the grubby reality of politics would strip away the mythology and reveal the man. This was a chaotic period. There would be trying times ahead, and it was inevitable that some of Paoli's Universal Admiration Society would be disillusioned. But who would be left out of Paoli's new regime was very much an open question. Paoli may have been the most famous political figure on the island, but he had been gone so long he was actually a bit of an unknown quantity. The political landscape had transformed over the course of 22 years, and the years had changed Paoli too. It's hard to pigeonhole Paoli's Republic of Corsica of the 1760s. On some issues, he'd been genuinely radical. For example, he'd instituted universal suffrage. Not even the Revolutionary Assembly in Paris had gone that far. But there had also been conservative elements to Paoli's regime. He had mostly worked within the traditional power structure. He sought to formalize and modernize the old clan system, to turn it into the foundation of a constitutional democratic system of government, rather than abolish it. In his decades of exile, that conservative side to Paoli came to dominate. Remember, he'd been in London, and most English Enlightenment intellectuals advocated reform over revolution. And for good reason. The British system had proved itself flexible and capable of reform. Their government had been transformed over the preceding century, but its actual formal structures had remained fundamentally unchanged. Paoli admired that. Like many more conservative adherents of the Enlightenment, he felt the British approach provided the right balance between progress and stability, and he thought it could work in Corsica. The old general returned home a committed Anglophile. Britain had been in a golden age during his exile, economically and intellectually, as well as politically. Paoli's celebrity had put him right at its epicenter. He'd spent more of his life in London than in Corsica. He was eager to emulate the British in almost everything. So there had always been a conservative streak in Paoli's politics, and the climate in Britain pulled him further right. And, of course, he was getting older, and maybe just becoming less idealistic with age, like so many people do. He had also grown bitter in exile. The young Paoli had been ecumenical, eager to forgive his enemies and win over his opponents. Now he burned with disdain for anyone who opposed him. He began to see his own political ambitions and the Corsican nation as synonymous. Opposing Paoli meant opposing Corsica, and you don't forgive and win over traitors, you eliminate them. So when all the romantic illusions fell away, and Paoli came to be seen as a regular human politician rather than a folk hero, he would be clearly on the center-right of the political spectrum, and quite authoritarian. It would be his radical and his liberal admirers who were disappointed. But in late 1790, that was still in the future. Despite their bad first impression, the Bonaparte brothers still hoped to earn Paoli's support for their political ambitions. They worked diligently to build up their profiles. For their radical politics, people in Ajaccio began to refer to the brothers as the Gracchi, after a famous political family from the ancient Roman Republic who championed populist causes. The Bonapartes were probably flattered by the comparison, but it may not have been intended as a compliment. In traditional patriarchal Corsica, radical was often synonymous with troublemaker or malcontent. That distrust of radicals became more intense as the revolutionary government came into conflict with the Catholic Church. Corsica was a very devout place. We talk a lot about the influence of Enlightenment rationalism and skepticism, but it's important to keep in mind that religiosity was nearly universal in the 18th century, and religious belief was typically felt with a depth and fervor you don't often find in the modern world. Even by the standards of a very devout era, Corsicans were seen as particularly pious. Corsica's loyalty to the Catholic Church wasn't just about people's personal convictions. The church on the island was relatively poor and connected to the population, compared to other parts of France. Around Paris, where the bishops lived in palaces and poor country priests starved, the church often looked corrupt, hypocritical, and effete. That wasn't so obvious on Corsica. So the smart play for any Corsican radical probably would have been to tiptoe around the religious issue, be cautious with any criticisms, and maybe stake out a softer position than the Parisian Jacobins. But does that sound like the Bonapartes? Words like cautious and softer weren't really in their dictionary. When the civil constitution of the clergy put the revolutionary government and the church on a collision course, Napoleon and Joseph came out swinging with a pamphlet in support of the law. In fact, they actually went further than the assembly, openly denouncing the church as a malign influence on society. A few weeks later, they were out walking in Ajaccio on the day of a religious festival. They had the misfortune of crossing paths with a procession of Catholic penitents. The brothers were recognized as the authors of that hated, blasphemous pamphlet, and the procession was quickly on the verge of turning into a lynch mob. Then one of the penitents stepped in front of the crowd and shouted, quote, "I will kill the first man who lays a hand on Lieutenant Bonaparte," end quote. Their savior was a man named Trentacoste, a famous bandit who was seen as a kind of Robin Hood figure. He had come down from the hills to wash away his doubtlessly grave sins. No one in the crowd doubted he was serious, and the incident ended quickly. Unfortunately, Trentacoste's reasons for intervening are lost to history.
Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach ja.
The brothers were physically unharmed, but their reputation suffered. Their attack on the church was a fiasco. But they did make some smarter moves in this period. When an older, more politically experienced cousin expressed his desire to run for mayor of Ajaccio, they backed his campaign and ran Joseph as his deputy. The Bonaparte ticket carried the day, but there was a problem. According to the Constitution, a deputy mayor had to be at least 25 years old. Joseph had been elected to an office he was too young to hold. Of course, his political opponents immediately seized upon this to try to get his election overturned. They even got a hold of his baptismal certificate, or a convincing forgery, and published it as widely as they could. It was quite the scandal, and Joseph's enemies were technically in the right, but it went nowhere. The new mayor stood by his young cousin. Family was more important than any constitution. And besides, he didn't speak French, and he needed a trusted deputy like Joseph to translate. Connections mattered a lot more than the letter of the law. While Joseph fought for his political life, Napoleon helped found a new political organization, the Patriotic Club. This was to be a Corsican version of the Jacobins. It would be devoted to radical politics and, as the name implies, Corsican nationalism, but not to Corsican independence. At this stage in his life, Napoleon had reconciled himself to the union with France. He still believed in Corsican autonomy and a separate national identity, but under the sovereignty of revolutionary France. The Patriotic Club circulated a petition around this time that was probably written at least in part by Napoleon. One line reads, quote, let us be French forever, end quote. As the revolution dragged on, the political scene in Corsica began to splinter into factions, just as it had in France. On the mainland, the divide was between supporters and opponents of the revolution. The battle lines were similar in Corsica, but there was a complicating factor: Pauli and the legacy of independence. Roughly, the island was divided into three factions: royalists, who were on the far right and favored the pre-revolutionary status quo; Paulisti, who were on the right and center and favored complete independence; and radicals, who were on the left and generally the most pro-French, although most still believed the island should have some degree of autonomy. There was a chasm opening between the Bonapartes and their erstwhile idol. On a purely interpersonal level, they had gotten off on the wrong foot, and now they found themselves in separate and increasingly opposed political camps. But perhaps naively, the brothers still dreamed of winning Pauli's support and approval, or at the very least, convincing him that they were not his enemies. After their poor first meeting, Napoleon and Joseph paid the old general a visit. Pauli had taken over a disused monastery in the Highlands and converted it into a kind of headquarters for his political faction. The Bonapartes trekked up to metaphorically kiss his ring. Maybe they were hoping to undo some of the damage Napoleon had done on the Ponte Novo battlefield. This meeting seems to have gone better than the first. By all accounts, Pauli was quite cordial. As a token of his esteem, he gave Joseph an old playing card from his days as a guerrilla warrior. Cards were used as secret symbols for the rebels to identify one another. Joseph and Napoleon were humbled by this gesture, but Pauli was a wily politician, and he still didn't totally trust the sons of Carlo Bonaparte. My guess would be he had a whole stack of playing cards that he handed out to well-wishers with a good story. But Napoleon and Joseph weren't just there for souvenirs. They had business to discuss. Joseph had already set his sights on higher political office, the Corsican Regional Assembly. Headstrong as the brothers were, they knew it would be interpreted as a slight if Joseph declared his candidacy without first seeking the general's blessing. For once, the Bonapartes were doing things properly according to the traditional norms of Corsican politics. They were showing respect to Pauli himself, and to that old way of doing things that he and his supporters valued. Despite his reservations about the Bonapartes, Pauli appreciated their deference. He stopped short of endorsing Joseph, but agreed to stay neutral in the race, which Joseph would ultimately win. The young Bonapartes were grandiose, idealistic, and openly ambitious. A lot of the Corsican old guard were offended by the way they carried themselves, saw them as pompous, uppity troublemakers. But at this meeting in the monastery, Pauli seems to have been more amused by their bombast. He was patronizing, but not hostile. He remarked to Napoleon, quote, "You are on the ancient model. You are one of Plutarch's characters," end quote. Napoleon loved Plutarch and took this as high praise. Maybe Pauli was flattering him, but on the other hand, characters in ancient histories like Plutarch's are known for turgid, self-serious monologues, so it might have been intended as a backhanded comment on his pomposity and youthful idealism. I tend to believe the latter reading. A cagey, jaded old politician like Pauli probably couldn't help smirking to himself while listening to the Bonapartes drone on about republican virtue. Still, Napoleon and Joseph got what they wanted. In his free time, Napoleon was still working on that history of Corsica he'd started years earlier. After the meeting at the monastery, he felt secure enough in Pauli's esteem that he sent him a draft and asked permission to dedicate the book to the old general. Unfortunately for the Bonapartes, this would be the high point in their relationship with Pauli. The political winds were pulling them in another direction, and they just couldn't resist courting controversy. In early 1791, Napoleon published a political pamphlet attacking the French governor of the island. As you would expect from Napoleon's writing of this period, it's completely over the top, absolutely scathing. He calls the governor a traitor and accuses him of deceiving Pauli and filling the capital with yes-men. Napoleon was very careful not to attack Pauli himself, but nonetheless the pamphlet infuriated him. It was true that the governor was part of the royalist faction, not a close ally, but Pauli needed to maintain a good relationship with him to govern the island effectively. He was walking a political tightrope between his own pro-independence faction and the remaining royal officials on the island, and with this incendiary pamphlet, Napoleon had just tossed him an anvil. Pauli's response was amazingly petty. The general finally wrote to Napoleon with a response to his manuscript. No, he would not allow the book to be dedicated in his honor. Not only that, he criticized Napoleon's writing style and arguments. Pauli said Napoleon was too immature to write history, and should abandon the project entirely. When Napoleon wrote him back, asking to return the manuscript, Pauli refused. He didn't know where it was, and didn't have time to look for it, he said. Remember, this is a 65-year-old man we're talking about, an important statesman, essentially bullying an anonymous 20-year-old. Like I said, Pauli had a vindictive streak. More seriously, back in Ajaccio, Joseph's political enemies hit him with some trumped-up charges of corruption. This type of thing was pretty common in Corsican politics. Typically, higher authorities stepped in to calm things down before they went too far, but not in this case. Pauli and his supporters just sit back and watched Joseph squirm. Clearly, the general was done humoring the Bonapartes. The split became formal in late 1791. The long-awaited formation of Ajaccio's National Guard unit was finally announced. There would be elections for officers in the new year. The unit would be led by two lieutenant colonels. Napoleon had been angling for one of those spots for over 2 years. He immediately declared his candidacy. This time, the Bonapartes didn't bother asking permission from Pauli. It was clear what his answer would have been. Pauli backed a rival candidate, Matteo Pozzo di Borgo, younger brother of Carlo Andrea Pozzo di Borgo, a leading Paulisti member of the assembly. The Pozzos were one of the wealthiest, most eminent families in the Ajaccio region. In Carlo Bonaparte's day, the two families had been close, but now the younger generation were on opposite sides of a widening political divide. That closeness had soured into an intense rivalry. Matteo and Carlo Andrea were almost like a mirror image of the Bonapartes, ambitious brothers from Ajaccio who were throwing all their youthful energy into politics, with the help of a powerful patron. But they were a bit older than the Bonapartes, and a bit more cynical. The Pozzo family was much wealthier, and both men were staunch conservatives. Carlo Andrea had been elected to the Estates General in 1789, and actually had been an ally of the king and the reactionary royal court, so he was even more right-wing than Pauli. The Bonapartes and the Pozzos had been raised to think of each other as friends, which made the hatred that grew between them all the more bitter. On top of the drama between the two families, the race between Matteo and Napoleon would become a proxy battle between the political factions of their respective patrons, Pasquale Pauli and his center-right pro-independence allies on the side of the Pozzos, and Christophe Salicetti and the pro-French radicals for the Bonapartes. Both men poured resources into the campaign. With such high stakes and the pre-existing bad blood between the candidates, it quickly became an ugly, corrupt affair, even by the low standards of 18th-century Corsican elections. Both sides took part in violence, intimidation, and bribery, right out in the open. Corsica's printers churned out pamphlets full of slander against the two rival families. This was way before there was such a thing as campaign finance regulation, so Pauli and Salicetti could quite openly pay for the ad blitz. Napoleon was a proud man who cared deeply about his public reputation and was fiercely loyal to his family. These attacks on Bonaparte honor pushed him past his limit. Even in the context of this dirty campaign, the Pozzos had gone too far, and he would make them pay. He challenged his rival to a duel. Matteo accepted, but then failed to show up at the appointed time and place. In most parts of Europe, this would have instantly ruined Pozzo's reputation, but dueling wasn't really practiced in Corsica. It certainly wasn't that Corsicans objected to the idea of avenging one's honor with deadly violence, but in a traditional Corsican vendetta, you don't go through all the formal steps of etiquette required for a duel. You just grab a knife and go get blood. Formalized continental-style dueling was considered a foolish French affectation. So it was actually Napoleon whose reputation was damaged by the incident. Still, the race seemed to be going Napoleon's way. By law and tradition, each candidate was required to officially address the electorate before the vote. Imagine if a modern political debate was just the closing statements from each candidate. The crowd was rowdy, of course, but Napoleon delivered his entire speech without incident. When it was Matteo Pozzo di Borgo's turn, the audience shouted him down, and he had to flee the stage. Depending on who you ask, this was either pre-planned by some of Salicetti's hired goons, or Napoleon was genuinely popular among the Ajaccio Guard volunteers, after spending so much time organizing the unit. In the weeks before the vote, three election commissioners arrived from the regional government. Their role would be observing the proceedings and certifying their fairness and integrity. Obviously, everyone knew there was zero chance of a fair, impartial election, including the commissioners. So this became just another front in the raging factional political war. Paoli and Salicetti each managed to get one of their own allies appointed to the three-man commission, leaving one unaligned official. When the commission arrived in Ajaccio, Paoli's man promptly accepted an invitation to stay at the Pozzo family home. Salicetti's man would be an honored guest of the Bonaparte family. As for the unaligned commissioner, we don't know where he would have stayed, because he was almost immediately kidnapped by Bonaparte loyalists. This sounds insane, but it was actually not without precedent in the wild world of Corsican politics. It was considered a low blow to be sure, but that's the type of race this was. Napoleon and his family actually treated the neutral commissioner very well. He got the same accommodations as his pro-Salicetti colleague, as if he had actually voluntarily chosen to be their guest. The Bonapartes told him they'd had no choice but to take him into protective custody as soon as possible, because the Pozzos had been plotting to murder him, which might have actually been true. February 22, 1792 was election day in Ajaccio. Both sides put every man and every coin to work making sure their supporters made it to the polls and their opponents did not. But when they arrived at the polling places, it immediately became clear this was a foregone conclusion. An outside National Guard unit had arrived overnight to provide security. A unit whose officers and men were all loyal to Salicetti. It had been made clear to them which side was supposed to win. Bonaparte supporters were allowed to use every dirty election day trick in the book with total impunity, while Pozzo supporters were turned away on any shoddy excuse the guardsmen could dream up. Napoleon won in a landslide. Had the election been stolen? Obviously, yes. But it wasn't like the losing side had put themselves at some disadvantage by refusing to fight dirty. Salicetti and Napoleon's cheating had simply been more effective than Paoli and Pozzo's cheating. The night of the election, I doubt Matteo Pozzo di Borgo was truly outraged. He was probably saying to himself, "Why didn't I think of that?" It's quite possible Napoleon would have won a fair vote, but we have no way of knowing. A fair vote in 18th century Corsica is a purely theoretical creature. Elections were tests of political muscle, not pure popularity contests. Everyone knew that going in. Paoli tried to open an inquiry into election irregularities, but he was blocked by Salicetti, and obviously he couldn't raise too big a stink. A real outside investigation would uncover plenty of dirt on him and his allies as well. So the matter was dropped. Legitimately or not, Napoleon had finally realized the goal he'd been working towards since returning to Corsica in 1789. At the age of just 21, he was a lieutenant colonel in the National Guard, a position of respect in his community that brought with it a degree of political power. But his victory at the polls had come at a cost. A few weeks before, the men of the Ajaccio Guard voted, an anonymous clerk at army headquarters in Paris moved Lieutenant Bonaparte's personnel file from the active to the inactive category, writing a note, quote, "He has given up his former profession," end quote. Napoleon had pushed his luck too far in overstaying his leave. In the eyes of the army, he was now an émigré, just one more officer of the thousands who had abandoned the French army. Ironic, given that he was actually an enthusiastic supporter of the revolution, but the army measured these things based on how long an officer was away, not by what his convictions were. Napoleon wasn't aware of this decision yet, but before long it would cause him headaches. Still, I'm not sure he would have done things differently. His priorities at this moment were all on Corsica. If he had to choose between his obligations to his homeland and his family, and his obligations to France and the army, I think it's pretty clear that at this stage, his choice was Corsica. His political opinions with relation to France had shifted, but his horizons had not yet expanded beyond the island. I think we'll leave things there for now. You might notice we're knocking off a little bit earlier than last time. I wanted to give you guys an update on some of the developments back in France, but I couldn't find a way to shoehorn it into the narrative, so I figured I'd just split them into two separate episodes. So look for that in the near future. Until then, thanks for listening.